A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been on a kick lately, digging into what world leaders were actually like behind the curtain. Not the statues and the street names, but the person. Today he's asking about Theodore Herzl. What did Herzl say about his own personality? How did his vision for a Jewish state take shape? And how does it differ from the reality of Israeli leadership today? There's a lot here, and honestly, the gap between the dream and what God built is wider than most people realize.
It really is, and I think the place to start is with who Herzl was before he became the father of modern Zionism, because that's the part that surprises people. He wasn't a rabbi, he wasn't a scholar of Jewish texts, he wasn't even particularly observant, he was a thoroughly assimilated secular Viennese journalist and playwright, a man of the theater. He wrote comedies and feuilletons for the Neue Freie Presse. He cared about his cravat, his walking stick, the cut of his coat. He was a dandy.
A dandy with a geopolitical vision. That's a combination you don't see every century.
He knew it was incongruous. That's what makes his diaries so fascinating. He was acutely self-aware about the mismatch between who he was and what he was attempting. In June of 1895, he wrote in his diary, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, "I had the solution to the Jewish question. I will write it down, but I am not sure I have the strength to carry it out." He's standing at the threshold of the idea that will define his legacy, and his first instinct is to doubt he's the right vessel for it.
That's remarkably candid. Most founders' diaries read like they're already drafting the statue inscription.
Herzl's don't. He wrote constantly about feeling out of place in mass politics. There's a diary entry from 1895 where he says, essentially, "I am not a leader of the masses, I am a writer. But the masses need a leader, so I must play the part." He saw leadership as a role he had to perform, not an identity he inhabited naturally.
He was acting. The playwright became his own lead character.
And the performance took a toll. Before the first Zionist Congress in Basel in 1897, he was so terrified of public speaking that he vomited backstage. 204 delegates from 17 countries, the first gathering of its kind, and the man who convened it was physically ill from the pressure.
Of course he was. The man who wrote drawing room comedies suddenly had to be Moses.
He actually called himself that in private. The Moses of his time. He wrote it in his diary. And that's the contradiction at the center of Herzl. He was simultaneously arrogant enough to compare himself to the prophet who led the Israelites out of Egypt, and insecure enough to fear his entire movement would collapse if he sneezed wrong.
That's not a contradiction, though. That's the same thing wearing two different coats. The grandiosity and the anxiety both come from the same place. The belief that it all hangs on you.
Which it largely did. The Zionist movement before Herzl was scattered, localized, mostly cultural. It was a patchwork of small groups. The Hovave Zion in Russia, student societies in Germany, agricultural enthusiasts who talked about returning to the land but had no political strategy. Herzl turned it into a political force with an international diplomatic strategy. He met with the German Kaiser, the Ottoman Sultan, the British Colonial Secretary Joseph Chamberlain. He was negotiating with empires while his own organization was barely a few years old.
That's an astonishing asymmetry. A journalist with no state, no army, no treasury, walking into the palaces of the world's most powerful men and saying, essentially, "I have a proposition for you." How did he even get those meetings?
Through sheer audacity and a very 19th century understanding of how power worked. Herzl believed that if he could just get face time with the right people, the Sultan, the Kaiser, the British aristocracy, he could convince them that a Jewish state would serve their interests. He pitched it to the Sultan as a solution to the Ottoman Empire's debt crisis. He pitched it to the British as a strategic outpost. He was always selling, always reframing, and he was remarkably good at getting in the door. What he was less good at was closing the deal.
Who was Herzl when the cameras were off? Let's start with what he said about himself.
He was married to Julie Nashauer, and the marriage was a disaster. She came from a wealthy family, they married young, and she resented his political work intensely. She didn't share his vision, didn't want to be part of the Zionist project, and felt abandoned as he traveled constantly for the cause. Herzl's letters suggest he felt guilty about this, but also viewed her as an obstacle to his mission.
That's a brutal binary. Your spouse or your life's work. Not a lot of people navigate that well.
He didn't. And it's worth pausing on what that actually looked like day to day. Herzl would be gone for months at a time. Constantinople, Berlin, London, Saint. Julie was left in Vienna with the children and a household to manage, and she didn't share the ideological fuel that made the sacrifice meaningful for him. For Herzl, the travel was exhausting but purposeful. For Julie, it was just abandonment with a political excuse. The letters between them grow increasingly cold. By the end, they were essentially living separate lives under the same roof. He neglected his children too, Hans, Pauline, and Trude. All three of them had tragic lives after his death. Hans converted to Christianity, then returned to Judaism, and eventually died by suicide in 1930. Pauline struggled with mental illness and died in a hospital in Bordeaux. Trude perished in the Theresienstadt concentration camp.
That's a heavy legacy for a man who was trying to save his people. His own family didn't make it through.
Here's the thing that makes it even more complicated. Herzl knew he was neglecting them. He wrote about it in his diaries with genuine anguish. There's an entry where he describes coming home after a long trip and realizing his son Hans barely recognized him. He felt the cost in real time. He just calculated that the cost was worth paying. Whether that calculation was correct is a question. His children's fates answer pretty brutally.
It's the trolley problem at the scale of a family. Sacrifice the people in front of you to save the people you'll never meet. Herzl pulled the lever.
Then his own body gave out before he could see the results. Herzl died in 1904 at the age of 44. The official cause was heart failure, but the contributing factors tell a story. He had rheumatic heart disease, and he had been undergoing treatments for syphilis, the standard mercury-based treatments of the era, which were themselves toxic. The stress of the movement, the financial strain of funding it largely out of his own pocket, the travel, the constant pressure, his body just gave out.
He crammed an entire political movement's founding into a handful of years, and then died before he could see any of it realized.
He knew he was racing against time. In his final years, he was increasingly desperate. The Uganda proposal in 1903, the British offer of territory in East Africa as a Jewish homeland, split the Zionist movement. Herzl supported it as a temporary refuge, a night asylum as he called it. The Russian Zionists, who were closer to the actual suffering of pogroms, saw it as a betrayal of the Zionist idea. They wanted Zion, not a substitute. Herzl died the following year, and the movement nearly fractured completely.
The Uganda proposal is one of those historical what-ifs that doesn't get enough attention. If Herzl had lived another decade, does the entire geography of the 20th century look different?
But it's also possible the movement would have splintered under him regardless. He was a unifier in many ways, but his vision was deeply personal. He didn't build an institution that could outlast him. He built a movement around his own charisma and diplomatic access.
Which connects to something important about the type of leader he was. He admitted he wasn't the man of action. He wrote that he was a visionary who needed others to execute. That's not false modesty. That's a job description. He was the architect. Not the contractor.
The contractors who actually built the state were very different men. David Ben-Gurion, the labor Zionists, the socialist pioneers. They didn't share Herzl's vision of a liberal, bourgeois, European-style republic. Herzl imagined something closer to Vienna with palm trees. Ben-Gurion built something closer to a socialist worker state with a strong centralized government.
That metaphor deserves more attention. Vienna with palm trees. Let's unpack what Herzl actually meant by that. He wasn't just imagining a pleasant Mediterranean city. He was imagining a specific kind of civilization transplanted wholesale.
Vienna in the 1890s was the capital of a multi-ethnic empire, a city of coffee houses and opera houses and boulevards where bourgeois Jews could be cultured, secular, and respected. Herzl wanted to recreate that, minus the anti-Semitism that kept breaking through the surface. He wanted a place where a Jewish journalist could be just a journalist, where Jewishness was unremarkable. The palm trees were the setting, but the content was European bourgeois normalcy.
That's the pivot point. Now that we know the man, let's look at the blueprint he left behind, and how it compares to what actually got built.
Herzl laid out his vision most clearly in his 1902 novel Altneuland, which translates to Old New Land. It's a utopian novel set in the future Jewish state. and the details are striking. He envisioned a secular, multi-ethnic society with full civil rights for non-Jews. Arabic would be an official language alongside Hebrew. The state would have a constitution. Technology would be central. He described hydroelectric power plants, electric railways, modern agriculture. It was a technocratic liberal dream.
Herzl's Zionism was fundamentally liberal, not nationalist in the ethnic sense we'd recognize today.
And that's the misconception most people have. They assume Herzl wanted a Jewish state in the way we understand it now, a nation-state defined by Jewish identity. But Herzl's model was closer to the 19th century European liberal state, where citizenship was based on civic participation, not ethnicity or religion. He explicitly wrote that non-Jews would have equal rights. In Altneuland, there's a character, a Muslim Arab engineer named Rashid Bey, who says the Jewish state has brought prosperity to everyone, and he's portrayed as a full participant in society.
The Muslim Arab engineer, as the emblem of the successful Jewish state. That's not exactly the marketing brochure you'd get today.
It's a world apart from the 2018 nation-state law, which downgraded Arabic from an official language to a, quote, special status, and defined Israel as the nation-state of the Jewish people alone. Herzl would have been appalled by that law. It's the precise opposite of his civic nationalism.
The 2023 judicial reform crisis. The fight over whether the Supreme Court can check the Knesset's power. That's also a direct challenge to Herzl's constitutional vision. He wanted a liberal democracy with separation of powers. What we've seen in recent years is a push toward majoritarian rule, where the legislature can override the courts.
Herzl didn't anticipate the power of religious parties either. In Altneuland, religion is a private matter. The state is secular. The temple in Jerusalem is rebuilt, but as a symbol, not a functioning site of worship. He imagined rabbis would have no role in governance. Compare that to today, where religious parties are often kingmakers in coalition governments and have shaped policy on everything from marriage to military service to public transportation on Shabbat.
The ironies compound. Herzl, the secular dandy who barely practiced Judaism, envisioned a state where religion was cordoned off from politics. Ben-Gurion, also secular, ended up cutting deals with the religious parties to maintain coalition stability. And now, 120 years after Herzl's death, the religious Zionist camp is arguably the most influential ideological force in Israeli politics.
This wasn't inevitable. There was a moment, really, a series of moments, where the relationship between religion and state could have gone differently. Ben-Gurion's decision to grant the rabbinate control over personal status law, marriage, divorce, conversion, was a political compromise, not an ideological commitment. He needed the religious parties in his coalition. Herzl, who never had to manage a coalition, could afford to be a purist about secularism. Ben-Gurion couldn't.
That's the difference between writing a novel and running a government. In the novel, you control all the characters. In the Knesset, the characters control you.
Let me read you something from Altneuland directly. Herzl wrote, and I'm quoting, "The Jewish state will be a model for the world, a place where all people live in peace and equality. That's not a nationalist manifesto. That's universalist liberalism with a Jewish address."
It's the musical equivalent of beige wallpaper in the best sense. A vision so earnestly reasonable it almost feels naive.
It was naive in important ways. Herzl didn't seriously grapple with what would happen if the Arab population rejected the project. In Altneuland, the Arabs welcome the Jews as bringers of progress. There's no war, no displacement, no competing national claims. The novel was published in 1902, before the major waves of Zionist immigration, before the Balfour Declaration, before the Nakba. He was writing before the conflict existed in its modern form.
That's the thing about utopian fiction. It's always set after the hard part got solved off-screen.
The hard part turned out to be the entire story. Herzl died believing the Jewish state would be established through diplomatic negotiation with the great powers. He got the charter he wanted, sort of, in the Balfour Declaration of 1917, 13 years after his death. But the state wasn't born in a conference room, it was born in a war. The actual founding in 1948 was forged by labor Zionists who had spent decades building socialist institutions. Kibbutzim, the Histadrut Labor Union, the Haganah Militia. They weren't liberal individualists, they were collectivists. They believed in state power, in national discipline, in the primacy of the collective over the individual.
Herzl gave the movement its diplomatic architecture and its symbolic center, but the people who actually poured the concrete had a completely different philosophy.
Ben-Gurion is the key figure here. Herzl was a Viennese journalist who wore frock coats and negotiated with sultans. Ben-Gurion was a Polish-born socialist who dug ditches and built a state bureaucracy. Herzl imagined a voluntary society of free citizens. Ben-Gurion built what scholars call statism, Mamlakhtyot, a centralized state where the government controlled immigration, education, land, and the military. Very different from Herzl's liberal minimalism.
Yet Herzl gets the statue, the street name, the mythic status. Ben-Gurion is respected but also resented. The founder who actually built the thing is controversial. The founder who dreamed it is beloved.
That's the luxury of dying early and leaving a beautiful blueprint. You never have to make the ugly compromises. Herzl didn't have to decide what to do about the Arab population of Palestine. He didn't have to manage coalition politics. He didn't have to choose between liberal ideals and security imperatives. He got to remain pure.
The patron saint of the idea, unsullied by implementation.
That's not a criticism of Herzl. It's a recognition of the gap between visionary and executor. Herzl himself understood this gap. He wrote that he was not a man of action, that he needed others to execute. He was honest about his limitations. The tragedy is that the executors who came after him had a fundamentally different vision of what they were building.
Let's contrast the two visions concretely. Herzl's liberal utopia versus the Israel that actually emerged. What are the sharpest points of divergence?
First, religion and state. Herzl wanted strict separation. The Israel that exists today has no civil marriage. Marriage and divorce are controlled by religious courts. There's no constitution, despite Herzl's insistence on one. Instead, Israel has basic laws that function as a quasi-constitution, but they can be amended by a simple Knesset majority, which is what the judicial reform fight was about.
No constitution, no civil marriage, and religious parties wielding disproportionate political power. Three strikes against the Herzlian blueprint.
Second, the status of non-Jewish citizens. Herzl envisioned full equality, Arabic as an official language, Arab citizens as full participants in civic life. The reality is more complicated. Arab citizens of Israel have formal legal equality, but they face systemic discrimination in land allocation, education funding, and policing. The nation-state law of 2018 made explicit what had been implicit, that Israel is the nation-state of the Jewish people, not of all its citizens.
That law feels like the clearest repudiation of Herzl's vision that you could draft without actually naming him.
Third, the economic model. Herzl was a bourgeois liberal. He imagined a market economy with private enterprise, technological innovation, hydroelectric power sold by private companies. What emerged in the early decades was a socialist economy dominated by the Histadrut, the labor federation that owned factories, construction companies, even a bank. Israel didn't really liberalize its economy until the 1980s and 90s, so for most of its history, the economic model was the opposite of what Herzl envisioned.
The kibbutz movement would have baffled him. Collective agriculture, shared property, children raised in communal children's houses. That's not the Vienna with palm trees vision.
He would have admired the technological achievement, though. Herzl was obsessed with technology. In Altneuland, he described electric trains, desalination plants, aerial trams. He would have been thrilled by Israel's emergence as a tech powerhouse, the startup nation phenomenon. That part he got right.
He got the tech right and the politics wrong. That's a pretty good summary of the 20th century's relationship with utopian thinking in general.
Here's another thing most people get wrong. They assume Herzl's vision was fully realized in 1948, but the state that was declared in May of that year was not Herzl's state, it was Ben-Gurion's state. The Declaration of Independence doesn't mention Herzl by name. It references the Zionist movement broadly, it invokes the Balfour Declaration, but the specific vision it articulates. A Jewish state that would be based on freedom, justice, and peace as envisaged by the prophets of Israel. That's Ben-Gurion's language, not Herzl's. Ben-Gurion was deeply shaped by the Hebrew Bible as a national epic. Herzl was shaped by European liberalism. Those are different intellectual genealogies.
Ben-Gurion statism, Mamlakhtyot, was almost the inverse of Herzl's liberal individualism. Ben-Gurion believed the state should be the central organizing principle of Jewish life. He dissolved the Palmach, the elite strike force of the Haganah, because it was affiliated with the left-wing kibbutz movement rather than the state. He wanted all armed forces under state control. Herzl probably would have been fine with private militias if they wore nice uniforms.
That's too far. Herzl did believe in a state with a monopoly on legitimate force. He wasn't an anarchist, but his vision of the state was thinner, more procedural. It would provide security and infrastructure and then get out of the way. Ben-Gurion's state was thick, interventionist, and deeply involved in shaping national culture.
Let's put some texture on that distinction, because thick versus thin state can sound abstract. Give me a concrete example of what Ben-Gurion's state did that Herzl's state wouldn't have.
Herzl imagined a liberal school system where parents chose among different options, some secular, some religious, some maybe bilingual. Ben-Gurion created a state school system that was explicitly designed to forge a unified national identity. Immigrant children from Yemen, Poland, and Morocco were all taught the same curriculum, the same Hebrew, the same national narrative. The state wasn't just providing education, it was manufacturing citizens. Herzl would have found that coercive.
Or take land. Herzl imagined private land ownership, a real estate market. Ben-Gurion's Israel nationalized most of the land. To this day, over 90% of Israeli land is owned by the state or the Jewish National Fund and leased to citizens. That's not a liberal property regime. That's state socialism with a nationalist overlay.
Those institutional choices have had incredibly long half-lives. The land regime shapes housing policy to this day. The education system shapes national identity. The rabbinate's control over marriage shapes the lives of every Israeli who wants to get married but can't or won't do it through the religious establishment. Herzl's blueprint looks elegant on paper, but the actual machinery of the state was built by people with very different tools.
What does this mean for us, decades later? Here are the key takeaways.
First, Herzl's story is a case study in how grand visions often require a disconnect between the founder's personality and the movement's needs. He was a reluctant leader, an introverted intellectual who forced himself into a role that made him physically ill because he believed no one else would do it. And it worked. The movement he created outlasted him and achieved its central goal. But the cost to him personally was catastrophic. Debt at 44, marriage in ruins, children who never recovered from his neglect.
That's the first insight. The founder is sacrifice. The second is about vision versus implementation. Herzl's liberal utopia and modern Israel's reality are so far apart that you could teach an entire political science course just on the gap between them. The religious parties he wanted to sideline now dominate coalition politics. The civic equality he promised non-Jews remains contested and incomplete. The constitution he insisted on still doesn't exist.
That gap is not just a historical curiosity, it's a live political issue. Every time Israel debates the nation-state law, or judicial reform, or the status of Arabic, or religious coercion, it's really debating whether to move closer to or further from the Herzlian vision. The founder's ghost is still in the room.
What can listeners actually do with this? I'd say read Altnoland. It's available for free online, it's not a long read, and it's genuinely illuminating. You can see the original blueprint, and then compare it to the building that actually got constructed. The dissonance is the education.
Read Herzl's diaries. The English edition is harder to find, but excerpts are widely available. The self-portrait that emerges, the vanity, the insecurity, the theatrical self-awareness is more human and more instructive than any biography.
There's a specific passage I want to flag for listeners who go digging into the diaries. There's a moment where Herzl describes standing in front of a mirror, practicing his posture and gestures before a major speech. He's literally rehearsing gravitas. He writes something like, "I must look like a leader until I become one." That's not a man who was born to command. That's a man who studied commanding like a part in a play.
That's what makes him so modern, honestly. In an era of carefully managed political personas, Herzl was doing it before it was standard practice. He understood that leadership is partly performance, and he was willing to perform even when it made him vomit. The question is whether the performance hollowed him out or filled him in. I think the evidence suggests it did both, in alternation.
Here's the open question. If Herzl were alive today, would he recognize the state he helped create? Would he be proud, horrified, or both?
I think he'd recognize the technology and be bewildered by the politics. He'd see the startup nation and feel vindicated. He'd see the religious parties and the Knesset and feel betrayed. He'd see the ongoing conflict with the Palestinians and realize his utopian novel left out the most important variable.
He might also see the sheer fact of Jewish sovereignty, a Jewish army, a Jewish foreign policy, a Jewish seat at the United Nations, and feel something beyond politics. He dreamed of normalization, of Jews being a nation among nations. That part happened.
And as Israel approaches its 80th anniversary in 2028, the tension between Herzl's vision and current reality will only intensify. The questions he raised about the character of the state, about the relationship between Jewish identity and democratic governance, about the rights of minorities, are not settled. They're more contested than ever.
The architect drew a liberal salon. The contractors built a fortress. And now the residents are arguing about whether to install stained glass or reinforce the walls.
That's the show, really. 120 years of renovation without ever agreeing on the original floor plan.
One more thing before we wrap. There's a fun fact buried in Herzl's biography that I think says something about the kind of mind he had. Before he became consumed by Zionism, he briefly entertained the idea that the solution to anti-Semitism was mass conversion of Jews to Christianity. He imagined leading a procession of Jews to St. Stephen's Cathedral in Vienna to be baptized. This was in 1893, 2 years before he wrote The Jewish State.
It's an astonishing detail, and it's easy to dismiss as a youthful indiscretion, but I think it reveals something structural about his thinking. Herzl's instinct was always to solve problems through grand theatrical gestures. A mass conversion. A diplomatic charter. A utopian novel. He thought in set pieces. The Dreyfus trial, which he covered as a journalist, was a set piece that radicalized him. The first Zionist Congress was a set piece he staged. His whole approach to politics was dramaturgical.
Which brings us full circle to the playwright who became his own lead character. The conversion idea failed, so he wrote a different script. One where Jews didn't have to stop being Jews, they just needed a stage of their own.
He got the stage built. He just didn't get to direct the production that opened on it.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1910s, a French marine biologist studying jellyfish off the coast of West Africa noted that the compass jellyfish, Chrysozora hyoscella, contains a yellow-brown pigment that is chemically similar to the Van Dyke brown pigment used by dyers in Mali's inland Niger Delta to color Bogolanfini mud cloth. Despite the two pigment sources having no ecological or geographic connection whatsoever.
I'm going to spend the rest of the day wondering how a jellyfish pigment ended up chemically identical to Malian textile dye. This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review if you're enjoying the show.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.